The first time I joined the party, a young man emerged from the woods a short distance from Carmel and hoisted himself onto the sweet-smelling hay. At first, I took him for a moonshiner because he was no sooner aboard than he began singing. Mother makes brandy from cherries. Pop distills whiskey and gin. Sister sells wine from the grapes on the vine. Good grief, how the money rolls in. Is hooch your hobby or your habit? I asked.
I never touch the stuff.
You're new around here. Just moved in.
My name's Ben Cohen.
Mine's Henrietta Fine, but my friends call me Henny. Like many Ukrainians, he had high cheekbones and pale blue eyes. His face was thin and his sandy hair already receding. A scar on the bridge of his nose resulted from his having fallen off a ladder and landed face down on a nail. His accent was barely discernible, owing, he said, to his having taken singing lessons, which taught him pronunciation. He had an imaginative turn of mind. On that first hayride, someone was recounting the awfulness of life under the Tsar. Ben agreed, but asked why it was that for all the sins of the Romanovs, Russia during that period had experienced a great flourishing of literature. Was it just chance, or did hard times provoke people to write?
The one thing we know for sure, he joked, is that the Romanovs were not sponsoring literary saloons.
He lived alone in a tar-papered house on a small piece of cultivated land. Only 2 acres had been hacked out of the woods, but he hoped someday to farm 50.
How old are you? He asked.
16. 17 next month. And you?
19. What brought you to America?
Both my parents died in the great flu epidemic.
My mom's been talking about farming.
Well, take a tip from me. Plant strawberries.
She mentioned tomatoes and peppers.
The price isn't right.
You been at it long?
My first year.
Do you like it?
I'd rather farm than work in a factory or the needle trade. On the land, you're free. No punching clocks, no piecework. I do just enough to get by. The rest of the time, I do what I want. Fish, swim, hike, you know.
Do you have plans for the future?
I'd like to write.
Have you written before?
I'm waiting for the winter, after the berries have been picked and a new crop is in.
You know what they say, Ben. It's good to plan. It's the waiting that spoils it.
Say, honey, you pitch horseshoes?
What's that?
A game. Would you like to try it?
Sure.
I'll teach you. At the Morris River, the men headed for one part of the woods and the women another to change into our bathing suits. The Sobelman boy yelled, "Last one in is a prune!" And we all dashed for the water. Because of the recent rains, the current was strong and the depth much greater than usual. We plunged in and let the current carry us about 50 yards downstream to a sandbar and then made our way through the woods to the starting point. You had to be careful to aim for the sandbar, otherwise you could be swept into a much deeper and wider part of the river. The water, cool and black, was home to numerous turtles sunning themselves on the logs. The light came through the trees on a slant, shading half the river and dappling the other. It was lyrical. It was rhapsodic. It was Eden. Alas, my dreaming made me careless. Floating downstream on my back, I failed to watch for the sandbar and was swept past it into the dangerous water. I yelled out for help. Ben, who was standing on the sandbar talking to friends, immediately dove into the river. In the midst of the swiftest part of the current, he caught up with me, taking my arm. Together we were carried downstream. Passing under a low-hanging tree limb, Ben tried to grab it, but as he did so, his grip on me loosened, and I was lost to the torrent. Shoved along, I kept telling myself just to keep swimming and beware of losing an eye to the submerged, splintered logs. Caught in a maelstrom,
I could hear only the rush of the water and the faraway cry of Ben's frantic voice. Henny! Hang on! For some stupid reason, I recalled the meaning of Moses' name, pulled from the water. If the Lord could save Moses, where was he now? I knew from the locals that when the river ran high, a certain low-lying area downstream thickened with rattlers bent on dry land. Suddenly, from out of the woods, thundered Ben's voice. A moment later, I saw him. He was racing down an old Indian trail that bordered the river. Arriving at a point in front of me, he dove into the water, grabbed my arm, and told me to hang on for dear life. Finally, he managed to haul me up on the bank. Standing there, shivering with fear and exhaustion, I could feel the soft moss underfoot and the warm air on my skin, and see, 50 feet ahead, the area noted for snakes. As we walked along the trail, we stopped from time to time to eat wild blackberries. Ben embraced my shoulder, and I hugged his waist. During that walk, I felt my first inkling of love. Having always regarded smooching as mush, I was flabbergasted to discover that when Ben leaned over and kissed me on the lips, a strange sensation coursed through my body, warming that place nice girls don't mention. To tell you the truth, I was scared. But I wasn't about to run off the way those dumb damsels in dime novels always do. I just smiled and said thank you and rejoined the others who were playing leapfrog. Running, placing our hands on the back of the person bending over, and leaping as far as we could, we marked the spot of our landing to see who had vaulted the farthest. I was third best, outjumped by only two men, Dave Skilovitz and Ben. When we tired of leapfrog, we ran several foot races. Again, I was third, and climbed a cedar tree on the bank of the river. Whooping and hollering like Indians, we swung branch to branch like apes. Ben asked me if I wanted a piggyback ride to the hay cart. So I swung from the tree onto his shoulders, and he jogged along at what he called a canter while singing, he said, like a cantor. I gave his pun a Bronx cheer. From that day forth, a communion united Ben and me so tightly that I thought I'd die if we were ever to part. As a mutual gift, we bought two canaries from Mr. Peckery and kept them caged on the porch. Mom's farmhouse became a regular nest of intrigue. While Malcolm Bird courted the princess, Ben came each day to see me. I called it the sewing circle, except that the princess wasn't stitching, she was spinning a web. The closest I came to spinning was the whirl I felt in my head from helping Ben in the fields and the stirrings in my heart. One day, Ben cycled up the road and told me excitedly that the anarchist, Claire Foyant, was to speak at Columbia Hall. Having read most of her writings, Ben claimed she represented an America that truly deserved the name Golden. But no one knows better than Miss Foyant, he remarked, how short we have fallen. The evening of the lecture, workers and wives, dressed in their Sunday best, quickly filled all the chairs. Latecomers stood along the sides and at the rear of the room. The crowd, easily more than 100, included Mr. Schneiderman and Malcolm Bird. The pine floors sagged, and the heat, made worse by the press of bodies and post-dinner flatulence, hung like a zeppelin. Some men threw open the screenless windows, admitting clouds of mosquitoes. Throughout the entire lecture, you could hear the sounds of slaps as we fought off the insects. From Ben, I learned that Claire was born in Michigan, the daughter of a poor seamstress and an itinerant tailor. Raised in poverty and sent to school in a Canadian convent, she learned early to hate economic systems that punish the poor and religions that frighten the young with such fire and brimstone they leave white scars on the soul. She had a wide, pretty face, though her mouth, turned down at the ends, made her look sad. Her long, unmanageable curls reminded me of my own, but what I remember most were her intense dark blue eyes and the scent of lavender that hung over her like a halo. She spoke as if branded into her flesh with the words justice and fairness. Her fiery words left us all dazed. The press called her headstrong. I called her courageous and ahead of her times. Decrying marriage as slavery and rape, whereby a man compels the woman he says that he loves to endure the agony of bearing children whom she does not want and for whom he cannot provide. She contended that to treat women as mentally inferior to men makes them children, irresponsible dolls, not to be trusted outside their doll's house. But her most corrosive comments she saved for an economic system that hurts and humiliates those who hope to survive. "I am standing on a mighty hill," she passionately cried, balancing on a milk crate at the front of the hall. "And from this height, I see the roofs of workshops and factories. I see the machines that men have made to ease their burden, iron genies. I see them set their steel teeth in the living flesh of the men who made them. I see the maimed and crippled stumps of men go limping away into the night that engulfs the poor. I see deep down in the hull of the ocean liner the men who shovel the coal, burned and seared like paper tossed in a grate. And I see in the lead works how men are poisoned, and in the sugar refineries how they're driven insane, and in the factories how they lose their decency, and in the stores how they learn to lie. And I know that it's economic slavery that makes them behave in this way." Wild cheers greeted the end of her speech, and before you could say strike, two men had lifted Claire onto their shoulders and carried her out to the road. A line of marchers formed and began walking downtown from Columbia Hall. Torches were lit, and someone started to sing the Marseillaise. Others joined in as the crowd coalesced at the corner. Like a swamp bird's cry, a wail pierced the night, and a police car, marked Bridgeton, wheeled out of the dark and into the road, blocking the way. Three burly fellows sprang from the car. One of them growled through a bullhorn that the march had gone far enough. Another step, he warned, and he would make mass arrests. "There's no place in America for anarchists," he warned. "All anarchists are socialists, and all socialists are enemies of the American way. So return to your homes and don't be misled by agitators and troublemakers." When no one moved, the cop threatened that the foreigners among us were running the risk of being deported. Claire, not one to be intimidated, pushed through the crowd. "If anarchy means equal relations between men and women, black and white, then I am an anarchist. If anarchy means an end to the perjuries and prejudices of big business, I am an anarchist. Now you know where to find me." This declaration earned Claire the wrath of the cop, who ordered his sidekicks to put her in cuffs. Two beefy mutts manacled her and started to lead her away, but the marchers encircled Claire and the cops, a menacing move that persuaded the law to abandon their catch and retreat. Claire faded into the crowd. The buster with the bullhorn made all kinds of dire threats, but no one listened. Irving Avenue was soon empty. When I returned to the farm, I found to my surprise and enjoyment Mr. Schneiderman entertaining Clairvoyant. "Your mother said she could stay here a few days," he said, "until the authorities lose interest. But we do have a problem. Claire is still cuffed, and your hacksaw won't work." From my dresser, I took Sully's tension wrench and pick. When I returned, Claire was sitting on Mr. Schneiderman's bed. He told her that she could sleep in his room and that he would bed down on the porch. I undid the cuffs, which were old warded locks and therefore a cinch. The cops put several workers in jail and said they'd keep them behind bars until they found the anarchist witch. But since no one read it, maybe because only a handful of people knew where she was, they began a house-to-house search. She stayed with us almost a fortnight before Wilbert Nair, a cop, knocked at the door. But I'll get to him in a minute. The time I spent with Claire, she taught me and the princess plenty, mostly about what she called the subordinated cramped circle prescribed for women in daily life. I learned through her how few were the opportunities open to girls outside of the house. Claire was the first woman who insisted that I attend college. My old aunts regarded schooling as an impediment to marriage and college the very worst. Though Mom wanted me to finish high school, she felt that too much education for a young woman would limit her chances to marry. I asked Claire why she never went to college. "No money. In its place, I've read myself bleary." But in my gut, I didn't feel ready to head back to school. The princess, present at most of our talks, was a rapt listener. At her next seance, she included much of Claire's message. This time, instead of his usual off-collar humor, Walter came from the spirit world, bearing advice. Women must be given equal wages and rights. Marriage was sacred only when equality was present. A number of her sitters, mostly men, expressed disapproval. But the princess claimed to know nothing of what Walter had said, since she was transported to another realm by her trance. Once word of Walter's new manners and message had spread, women began to displace men at the now thrice-weekly seances. When I told Ben about Claire's using our house as a hideout and about the princess's resorting to a trance to distance herself from her message, he said the women in the reform movement had employed that trick before. We were standing in a grassy field not far from his house. He was at last teaching me how to pitch horseshoes. "Here, get the feel of them," he said, clanging the shoes. "They don't look like the ones I see at the blacksmith's." "Oh, these are made specially for sport." "There's a reward, you know."
"For pitching horseshoes?"
"For Claire." "Why is it that when people want something badly, they offer money?"
"Perhaps because greed is stronger than love. How do you plan to protect her from the house-to-house searches?"
"Mr. Schneiderman made her a suit of men's clothes. When she's not in her room, she wears the trousers and jacket, topped off with a jaunty French beret. She could easily pass for a man, especially now that she's cut her hair short." Ben said, "You see the two metal rods sticking in the ground? They're the pins that you aim for. They're 40 feet apart. But since you're a girl, you get to stand 10 feet closer." With Claire in mind, I interrupted, telling him that if 40 feet was the distance for men, I wanted no less. He shrugged and continued. "Each player has two horseshoes. You pitch two, I pitch two, or vice versa. The player who goes first has the advantage because if his shoes are close to the peg, the second player has to top or dislodge them. No easy thing. To score, you have to land within one shoe width of the peg. That's worth 1 point. Or you have to make a ringer, meaning your shoe collars the peg, and that's worth 3 points. Leaners count only as one. It takes 21 points to win."
"Do you throw without moving your feet?"
"When you're learning," said Ben, "it's better to step. Give it a try." I pitched one shoe, which fell short of the peg and rolled to one side. The same with the second. "A shoe's easier to control if you hold it at the bottom of the U instead of at one of the ends. Yours rolled because it was thrown too low. You have to give it more lift, like this." Ben's pitch landed right next to the peg. I tried over and over again, but couldn't cover the distance. All my throws came up short. Without so much as a single "I told you so," Ben marked off 2 places 5 feet in front of each peg, cutting the distance I had to throw from 40 to 30 feet. With that alteration, I could reach the posts. But my horseshoes still went awry, landing wide or short. Finally, in frustration, I asked, What other games can we play?
Ben smiled and said, Do you wrestle?